The Monocle Quality of Life Conference returns, and this time we're touching down in Zurich. Join Monocle's editors and a lineup of tack-sharp panelists for lively debate, informed conversation, and top-notch hospitality from the 28th to the 30th of June. Find out more and book your ticket now at conference.monocle.com.
Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme, reclaiming the streets.
I believe that we will win!
Politics and city living are intertwined, and there's no better place to witness it than at a demonstration. Be it a student's march, silent walkout, or pro-immigration protest, it's about people coming together in a public space for a rallying cry that screams, enough. This week, we're in Lisbon, where the success of the city has left locals asking, what about us? In Moscow, we revisit the site that served as the stage for some of the city's biggest demonstrations, and a president starts to be defined by one march after another. That's all coming up over the next 30 minutes, right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. We start today's episode of The Urbanist in Brazil, where the nation's second biggest city, Rio de Janeiro, has been attracting a lot of unwanted attention lately. Violent crime continues to rise, and the military has been deployed to patrol the city, the first time the Brazilian government has officially done this since the dictatorship ended in the mid-1980s. But one recent event has triggered protests all across Brazil. On March 14th, Rio de Janeiro City Councillor Marielle Franco was killed in a drive-by shooting after leaving an event downtown. It's been said that the attack was planned and that Marielle was targeted because she opposed the military intervention in Rio and openly called out military police violence. Monocle's contributing editor, Sheena Roster, has been attending those protests in Brazil and tells us about this pivotal moment in Latin America's largest nation.
Vamos abrir o noticiário falando da morte da vereadora Marielle Franco do PSOL, ela que tinha 38 anos e dedicou boa parte da sua vida à luta pelos direitos humanos.
It was news that rattled Brazilians across the country. Rio de Janeiro City Councillor Marielle Franco had been shot 9 times, 5 of those shots to the head, in a drive-by attack in the city's downtown core. It's been reported that the bullets were issued by Brazilian federal police. In what's said to have been a planned attack around 10 p.m. local time on a Wednesday night, after Marielle left an event where she spoke about empowerment for Brazilian women of color, 2 silver sedans trailed Marielle's car, and the 2 attackers fired shots into the back of the car where Marielle was sitting as they drove by. The shot struck her and her driver, Anderson Gomez, too, who also died. Marielle Franco's press attaché, who is sitting beside her, miraculously survived and is currently in witness protection. Now, there's some important points that need to be said that explain why Marielle Franco's untimely death is significant in Brazil. Marielle, a left-leaning politician, was said to be the voice of some of Rio's most marginalized residents. She was black, she was a member of the LGBT community, and she was born and raised in Complexo da Maré, one of the city's largest favela complexes. Of Rio de Janeiro's 51 city councillors, she was one of only a few women, and the only black woman to be represented. She was also educated with a master's degree in sociology, and she was popular. With over 46,000 votes, she was the 5th most voted city councillor in all of Brazil when she was elected in October 2016. To middle and working class Brazilians, the planned attack on Marielle has been viewed as power silencing the voice of the people. The day after Marielle's murder, the protests started. Hundreds of thousands of Brazilians took to the streets protesting her death, the highest number of protests Latin America's largest nation has seen since the 2013 protests over rising bus fares. And they spread well beyond the borders of Rio de Janeiro. Even though Marielle was a city councilor for Rio de Janeiro City, the whole country mobilized against police violence. In Sao Paulo, crowds called for an end to Brazil's military police, a state-by-state police force that was started during Brazil's military dictatorship, and which are known for their brutal policing tactics. Isabel Fontana Caldas, an Afro-Brazilian woman in her mid-50s, has come to the protests in Sao Paulo with her 25-year-old daughter. She tells me that the death of Marielle Franco is very painful for her. Isabel says, having lived through Brazil's military dictatorship in the 70s and 80s, actions like the planned attack on Marielle Franco is a reminder of that time. Isabel tells me that she's fearful that the dictatorship time is coming back to Brazil. In Rio de Janeiro, protests on the streets have been nearly a daily occurrence, with Rio residents, cariocas, taking to the streets in high numbers since Marielle's death.
Isabelle Benito. Bom dia, Clóvis Monteiro. Bom dia, família Tupi.
At a popular working-class radio station in Rio de Janeiro, presenter Isabelle Benito's program has been regularly dominated by the topic of the city's rising gun violence. Shocked and saddened by the death of Marielle Franco, a woman Isabelle Benito personally knew, Isabelle has helped use her show as a platform to highlight what happened to Marielle. Marielle wasn't murdered. She was executed, Isabelle exclaims.
Fortes de indignação quando a gente quer dizer no caso da Marielle.
I think that we need to use as many strong words as possible when speaking about the death of Marielle Franco, she says. When she was executed, not only was she executed, she tells me, but so was democracy in Brazil. She tells me that Marielle's death was a shot to everyone that voted for her and a shot to all the population that needed their rights to be guaranteed by people like Marielle Franco, who were vocal about police violence. Far from the streets and the radio airwaves, academic panels on Brazilian race relations and women's rights have been overflowing with attendees in recent weeks, too. A slight silver lining to Marielle's death has been the increased consciousness about human rights in Brazil.
Da imprensa, e não queríamos fazer essa associação da casa com...
Edmeria Sultão is an activist for Black Brazilian women, which she tells me suffer the most in Brazilian society. Just 20 minutes before Marielle was murdered, Marielle was speaking at Casa das Pretas NGO with Edmeria.
Porque a Marielle representava assim uma voz.
She tells me that this is the worst thing that could have happened. We tried to have a voice. She was a voice for Black women, Edmeri tells me. She was an elected official. She was an esteemed person who wasn't afraid to speak her mind, she says. But that's why she bothered a lot of people. She wasn't scared to speak.
Além do mais, por ser mulher e negra e combativa, é possível aceitar isso? É possível aceitar que no Brasil...
Ousted President Dilma Rousseff has weighed in on Marielle Franco's death, too.
Uma forma mitigada de democracia, onde?
At a press conference in Rio de Janeiro this week, the former president referred to the increasing violence in Brazil as a method that the government is using to contain Brazilian consciousness and political expression, and that this is what happened in the case of Marielle Franco's death. Just over 2 weeks after Marielle Franco's murder, there currently aren't any suspects, and police continue to investigate. With Brazil's general election happening in October, this is a pivotal moment for the country that's only been split further along race and class divisions. Will change come in a country that has an unemployment rate of about 12% and increasing violence? Or will all of this just be a faded memory in the ever-evolving and dramatic Brazilian political landscape? For those voices here on the streets in Brazil, they seem to be fighting for a change for a better Brazil. For Monocle, in Rio de Janeiro, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Now, Moscow offers a lot of space for protests and rallies, and the anti-Kremlin movement of 2011 to 2012, triggered by the rigging of a parliamentary election that winter, took full advantage of the city's squares and avenues. Monocle's Alexei Korolyov, who was there, visits one of Moscow's key protest sites to see what has changed in the years that have passed.
The cold Moscow winter of 2011-2012, the first time since the breakup of the Soviet Union that so many Russians had taken to the streets. This was the brightest moment of hope for Russia's opposition movement. As tens of thousands gathered in Moscow that winter, it seemed as though a great new era of political and social freedom was just round the corner. But that moment proved extremely short-lived. As Vladimir Putin returned to the presidency in May 2012, after 4 years as prime minister, the crackdown began. It was here on Bolotnaya Square, in the very heart of Moscow, that the last big protest rally took place on the eve of Vladimir Putin's inauguration. In contrast to the previous rallies, this one ended in violence, leading to dozens of arrests and jail sentences. The opposition's momentum was lost. Today, this place looks a great deal more peaceful. The perimeter of the square is lined with tourist buses and taxis, and the wooden benches are occupied not by angry demonstrators, but by mothers with prams. But the name, Bolotnaya, has become the byword for political dissent in Russia, and is often used, albeit negatively, on federal television. Moscow City Hall has tried hard to erase that word association. Over the past 4 years, the Russian capital has been undergoing a massive renovation, and Bolotnaya, along with a few other traditional protest sites across the city, has been caught up in it. To be fair, it has actually fared much better than the others. Triumphalne Square, for example, is now completely unrecognisable, a far cry from when it hosted unsanctioned demonstrations in the late 2000s. But Bolotnaya is different. It has kept its revolutionary spirit. That's largely thanks to the authorities themselves, who made a big show of prosecuting a handful of demonstrators held here in 2012. They are known as the Bolotnaya prisoners. The last of the group was only released in February, nearly 6 years after the protest. And so Bologna will forever be a reminder of that near revolution. And maybe someday it will be the site of a real one. For Monaco in Moscow, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Unlike Spain or Greece, urban political resistance in Portugal has largely been limited to small grassroots actions and largely been unnoticed by the mainstream media. But since 2010, the country has gone from extreme austerity to extreme wealth, and some citizens feel that they've been left behind in the turnaround, particularly when it comes to fair access to housing. Our contributor in the city, Saima Tarek, meets with some of the organisers behind the Rock in Riot protest, which united several groups to make noise about this issue, and at the same time, well, have a bit of a party too.
In a small community space in downtown Lisbon, a few volunteers are busy chopping. They are preparing a dinner that aims to raise funds for a demonstration that, in many respects, has not happened in this city before. Rock in Riot, a play on the name of mega festival Rock in Rio, is a diverse organisation of individuals, housing activists, cultural agents and residents associations who have all come together with one goal: to occupy the streets and reclaim the city. In a couple of days' time, this protest slash street party will cross a large section of central Lisbon. Many well-known artists from the city's flourishing music scene have signed up to play. In the midst of rampant property speculation, and the evictions, demolitions, rent increases and displacement that come with that, a universal cause has united Lisbon's non-aligned cultural agents and its grassroots organisations. As a ping-pong match starts in the bar, Bernardo and Tiago, two of the event's organisers, explains why it's happening now.
More than a party, it's a cultural event to make people think. This is something that everyone is talking about, this housing issue, and there are a lot of news coming out every day about this. There is a lot of people talking on the streets. We, as the organizers of this event, don't have something specific to discuss with politicians. We don't have an agenda, we don't have... a lot of these different groups have their own stuff they are negotiating with public authorities. What we are trying to do is to make everyone aware that there are all of these different things happening in the city that are connected with one another, but we don't pretend to have answers to them all, but we are trying to find them.
Lisbon is going through an ambiguous process in the sense that at the same time you find like a different culture of participation, of activism, of producing art and culture together is emerging at the same time where the infrastructure and spaces for that are disappearing. The popular perception of these changes is often superficial. In the sense, since you see an increase in tourism, a lot of people think that, like, okay, this is like the tourists coming in, and a lot of people blame the rise in prices on that. From our perspective, we tend to see it more as a totality. It's not a question of asking the state to regulate tourism, to regulate platform renting of houses such as Airbnb and things like that, but like the political issue around all these issues is to try to develop ways of reappropriating the city that can in a sense constitute or build or inaugurate different ways of living the city.
On the day, around 2,000 people have shown up to the march. An achievement considering this has been in the planning for just a month and a half. Two pickup trucks, one with live bands, one with DJs, and both with impressive homemade sound systems, are slowly and loudly making their way through a crowd armed with banners, juggling sticks, horns and drums. The whole thing lasts for around 10 hours. The feeling is overwhelmingly festive, with much of the signage and graffiti making wry jokes about the contemporary political and economic situation. Habita, a group advocating for the rights of people who've lost their homes, are key actors in the event, as well as a residents' assembly that involves people from four peripheral neighbourhoods. These suburbs, home to a large Afro-Portuguese community, have been suffering from evictions long before this issue reached the city centre. We are an association of residents, coming from Bairro do Tour, Bairro de Jamaica, Quinta do Fonte and Seix de Maio. There are 250 families without housing and with precarious conditions. We need housing, but the government doesn't listen. There are many demolitions, mainly in Seix de Maio. It can't stay like this, it's unhuman. That is why we are here. Mariana, another young Rocking Riot organizer, was involved with the CGDP general strike 5 years ago. Protests in Lisbon have historically been led by institutions such as political parties or unions, which means this event has already marked a kind of paradigm shift. Its inclusion of different perspectives and positions comes after years of relative quiet.
In the last 5 years or something, nothing like this happened. I don't know why, but everything is like really calm. I think people are working too much. They don't have time to organize and to do politics and to discuss ideas. Yeah.
So how do you guys find the time?
Well, I don't know. I'm really tired. Like, we are having meetings until 1 a.m. maybe, because people are working until 8, until 9, and we have to dinner here, like in RDA. And after that, we have meetings until 1 a.m. It's crazy. I'm really tired. We are talking about that problem of habitation and gentrification. The owner of my house just kicked me out, and I have 2 months for go away and find another place to stay. And I think all my friends are in the same situation, and old people are being exposed from their houses too, so it's a general problem. I met like a lot of different people and a lot of different collectives, and I think now we are more stronger than before. So the process, it was great. Yesterday we received an email from an old lady to say that, oh, I just discovered Rocking Riot, how can I participate? And she explained our situation, and we are receiving emails from Brazilian people that are here and are having these type of problems, and they are like asking if they can participate or something, and we are like, of course, it's for everyone. So I think a lot of people are contacting us, and the Rocking Riot, our meetings have a lot of different people too, so I think it means something, you know?
On the surface, Rocking Riot seems like a music festival with a political conscience. In reality, it's the beginning of an important moment of resistance in Portugal. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Simon Tarek.
We wrap up this episode of The Urbanist with a look back at the beginning of the week. Last weekend in the United States, hundreds of thousands, perhaps even millions of people, took to the streets to demand action on gun reform. And it wasn't just stateside either. More than 800 cities across the world joined in solidarity with sister marches too. The March for Our Lives has already been described by some analysts as one of the biggest youth protests since the Vietnam War, topping the Women's March in 2017, which happened just days after the new US president was sworn in. Our New York Bureau Chief Ed Stocker looks back at these recent protests and ponders whether Donald Trump's presidency will be defined by people raising their voices in protests rather than support.
US cities transformed into sites of mass protest. Hundreds of thousands of people marching around metropolises including Washington DC, New York, Portland, Los Angeles, and of course Parkland, Florida. In scenes reminiscent of the Women's March back in January of 2017, the gatherings were in many ways a vote of confidence, or rather a lack of it, in the presidency of Donald J. Trump. This time people saying enough is enough when it comes to gun violence, and frustration at a Republican-controlled Congress's reluctance to do anything. The big question is whether it can last. The students at Marjorie Stoney Douglas in Parkland have managed to grab the media attention that neither the parents of the victims of Sandy Hook, a shooting in Connecticut in 2012, or the families of those affected by gun violence in Chicago have managed.
And that we represent those students that have lost their lives not only in Parkland, but at Sandy Hook and Columbine as well.
But what seems now like it is a fresh wave, led by the very people who are suffering from mass shootings in schools, has to have the momentum to keep its focus and stay the course. If protests of its sort continue in major cities, there's no reason to believe that change can't come. But one also has to remember that cities aren't an entire nation, and the US's politicians are a stubborn bunch. Add to the mix a recent NBC News Wall Street Journal poll that shows 58% of Americans agree with the statement that gun ownership does more to increase safety. Yes, the images beamed around the world at the recent protests have been powerful. Who can easily forget the shaved head of Emma Gonzalez standing in front of a microphone, tears streaming down her cheeks in silence? Or the 11-year-old girl who said she was there to represent African-American women who were victims of gun violence and whose stories hadn't been told.
I represent the African-American women who are victims of gun violence, who are simply statistics instead of vibrant, beautiful girls that pull up potential.
But politicians have been largely unmoved. True, there seems to be a green light for more research into gun violence, and the Justice Department has proposed banning bump stocks, although it's yet to be achieved. Little, though, on raising the age of buying a gun federally to 21, or closing loopholes.
No one could comprehend the devastating aftermath or how far this would reach or where this would go. For those who still can't comprehend because they refuse to, I'll tell you where it went. Right into the ground, 6 feet deep.
Is real change coming? It may take years or even a generation. And the voice of the young will have to rise and spread to other cities and beyond if it's going to happen. One thing does seem clear, though. Protests during the Trump presidency are here to stay.
I believe that we will win.
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 I believe. I believe. I
believe.
That was Monocle's New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker. And that's all we have for this week's episode of The Urbanist. The show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and it was edited by David Stevens. To play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here are the Arctic Monkeys with Riot Van. Thank you for listening, city lovers.
Got a chase last night from men with truncheons dressed in hats. We didn't do that much wrong, still ran away though for the laugh. Just for the laugh. And please just stop talking, 'cause they won't find us if you do.